This is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Support for KUAF comes from the Fayetteville Underground, promoting the visual arts in Northwest Arkansas, supporting artists working to the highest standards, and contributing to the advancement of Fayetteville as a destination city for the arts. Information regarding art shows, concerts, and more available at FayettevilleUnderground.com.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, education and business leaders are addressing the issue of improving broadband access in public schools. Ruby Brock from Talk Business Arkansas speaks with the chairman of a task force working on this initiative. Plus, we spend some time outside with a Benton County man who has spent years restoring Ozark native prairies.
Also, a business owner brings a unique beat to downtown Springdale with his drum shop. The Ozarks Genealogical Society prepares for its annual conference and more. But first, legal maneuvering continues over Arkansas's ban on most abortions 12 weeks into a pregnancy. A federal judge had already granted a temporary injunction back in May that hindered the new law from being implemented in July. Now, lawyers with the American Civil Liberties Union of Arkansas and the Center for Reproductive Rights want the judge to issue a permanent injunction that will prevent the law from ever being enforced. Lawyer Bettina Brownstein with the ACLU of Arkansas says their request for a summary judgment last week was one more step in a long process.
Would the parties get to file some more stuff, so that'll take a few more weeks. Then it's in the hands of the judge to decide. And, you know, the judge doesn't really have a time limit. She can take as long as she wants. I think we'll get a pretty quick ruling. I can't guarantee it, of course, but she's already decided most of the issues by issuing the preliminary injunction. She just really has to ponder the severability question.
That question is based on the position of the defendants, who assert that certain aspects of Arkansas's ban on abortions can be upheld. The defendants argue the ultrasound can help women make a sound decision on whether to terminate a pregnancy. The Republican-led state legislature enacted the 12-week ban in March when it overrode a veto from Democratic Governor Mike Beebe.
Northwest Arkansas Regional Airport has received a sizable grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation. Members of Arkansas's congressional delegation announced yesterday that the airport has received $3.4 million from the U.S. Department of Transportation. Kelly Johnson is the airport director of XNA. She says while $2.5 million will be used to reimburse the airport for part of the costs of renovations to the concourse, the remainder of the grant will be used in a variety of ways.
We'll be using about $575,000 to add an extra two lanes of pavement to the ramp at the end of the north end of that concourse. So that will allow us to get larger aircraft around the end of the building for parking on the other side. In addition to that, there's $500,000 there for a master plan update. We haven't updated the airport's master plan since 2002. And last but not least is $183,000 for a sweeper truck that we need for all the extra pavement that we've added over the last several years.
Johnson says the master plan will provide a necessary roadmap for planning the future of the airport.
It analyzes the facilities that are here, facilities that are needed. It does aviation forecasting for passengers as well as demand analysis, runway utilization. It encompasses an economic impact for the airport. It touches on a lot of different things. In conjunction with that project, we received a pilot grant last year for $300,000 for a sustainable master plan. So those two projects go hand in hand.
Johnson says discretionary money from the Department of Transportation and the Federal Aviation Administration allows the airport to keep improvements at pace with the number of passengers that use the airport every year.
The city of Fayetteville is working to improve a park on top of Mount Sequoia. The Parks Department is making several improvements to Mount Sequoia Gardens, including installation of an open-air arbor, improving the park's access drive and parking area, and creation of ADA-accessible sidewalks around the park. Carol Jones, a park planner with the city, says the park is designated as a neighborhood park, meaning it's intended to serve the immediate neighborhood and surrounding half-mile radius. She says the park potentially serves about 1,900 residents.
You know, the next closest park is Mount Sequoia Woods or Walker Park, which one has to cross 71 to get to Walker Park from this neighborhood. So these improvements are not just for the neighborhood, they're for all citizens. But they're hopefully going to provide the improved access by car and also the ADA access, the disability access, And also, we hope that it will provide a nice place for people to enjoy the view.
Jones says the park has been owned by the city for several years. Originally used as a water treatment facility, the development into a park began about 15 years ago, well after the city began purchasing water from the Beaver Water District.
A group of citizens approached the Parks Recreation Advisory Board, or PRAB, and said, hey, we would really like to take this into the park system. And in that same year, the city council passed a resolution doing just that. Even though the city already owned the property, they agreed to put it into the park system. And that was in August of 1998. And so since that time, citizens have been interested in there being some sort of overlook at that property since, you know, the views are so great.
The roughly $72,000 improvements are being paid for with parks development funds from the city's hotel, motel, restaurant tax proceeds and should be complete by November.
Public meetings are being held across the state to get residents' input on an update of the state's 10-year solid waste plan. As mandated by state law, the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, the 13 solid waste districts across the state, and other government agencies must assess where the state is at in regards to disposal and reduction of solid waste. Karen Bassett is the Chief Deputy Director of the ADEQ. She says while the original plan from 2003 was focused on improving collection and disposal infrastructure in the state, aimed at curbing illegal dumping along creeks and county roads, much has changed in the draft of this year's plan.
This plan is really focused on diverting waste from landfills and either eliminating it at the source or recycling, reusing it, and doing anything you can with it other than landfilling it, only truly landfilling those things that have no resource value.
Bassett says the reason meetings are being held across the state is so that the plan can be representative not only of the needs and goals of cities, industries, and solid waste districts of the state, but also of the range of Arkansas residents' mindsets on solid waste collection and reduction. She also says the meetings and the 10-year plan serve as a progress report for the solid waste districts.
Each district will be providing a status of where their district currently is, what services they currently provide, what they're thinking about providing to move the district further along. So it really depends on where the district is compared to where these 10-year goals want to take us by 2023. But Northwest Arkansas is a pretty green area, and we think the citizens there will be pushing the envelope for more services. We hope they will.
A public input meeting for the 10-year solid waste plan will be hosted by the Benton County Solid Waste District at 5 o'clock tomorrow night at Centerton City Hall. A similar meeting will be hosted August 2nd by the Boston Mountain Solid Waste District at the Jones Center in Springdale for residents of Washington and Madison counties.
Northwest Arkansas Natural's second game of a three-game series against the Arkansas Travelers was suspended in the 10th inning last night because of a thunderstorm. That game is scheduled to be completed tonight at Arvest Ballpark in Springdale, followed by the originally scheduled Wednesday night ball game.
Partly cloudy tonight with lows from 65 in northwest Arkansas to 71 in the Arkansas River Valley. A slight chance of showers in the Arkansas River Valley tomorrow and highs in the upper 80s across the listening area. Mostly cloudy tomorrow night with a 60% chance of showers and a low of 67 in northwest Arkansas and a 40% chance of showers with a low of 71 in the Arkansas River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. More than a week and a half ago, Governor Mike Beebe convened a group of business and education leaders to address a major concern, improving broadband access in the state's public schools. The state is lagging with its online learning opportunities, and some looming deadlines are compounding the situation. To learn more, Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business Arkansas recently spoke with Axiom executive Jerry Jones, chairman of a task force called FASTER that's working on this initiative.
Tell me a little bit about FASTER, fast access for students, teachers, and economic results. We have to have a good acronym to do these things.
Well, you do. And, you know, the governor asked me to get involved with this project a couple of weeks ago. And the project was that there is a deficit of broadband accessibility and capability within our schools in Arkansas. And as the governor has been talking for many, many years, education is a foundation for economic results and economic opportunity and development in the state of Arkansas as well. So while we started out with the acronym FAST, fast access student and teachers, he let me know that he wanted it to be a little bit broader mandate and to take a look at higher broadband speeds and capabilities across the state of Arkansas, hence the ER on the end of FAST, and it became FASTER.
We're not alone in our deficiency in broadband capability and access. Other states have this similar problem too. Kind of define the problem for me. How far behind do you think we are in terms of broadband access? And is it something that's going to take years to catch up to, or do you think it's got a shorter time span than that?
Well, we are behind, and we can argue about exactly where we are on a relative scale, but all of the studies that I have shown show that we're way behind at the present time, and some studies show that we're, you know, in the 40s and 50th, actually, so among the United States states. So we know that we've got to do better. But are we so far behind that we can't catch up? Absolutely not. You know, one of the benefits, actually, of an opportunity of being this far behind is technology has moved forward so fast that now that we can deploy different types of technologies and catch up in a hurry if we bring everybody to the table and move in the same direction, which I think that we're going to do, and that's why the governor asked that we bring this group together.
Tell me a little bit about some of the different people on this FASTER group that you're the chair of. You've got internet service providers such as AT&T. You've also got education folks as well. Just tell me, how broad is this panel?
Well, that's right. We tried to bring together a broad coalition of people in Arkansas, educators, technologists, business people, people that are involved in the political sphere as well, and the media and public relations sphere as well, so that we are diverse from a geographical, from a business perspective, as well as a general perspective. We have a lot of diversity in that room, so that we can look at these issues from a variety of different directions. It's a very, very solid group. I'm very appreciative of the people who are taking their time to devote to this effort. And the effort is not to sit around and admire the problem. We've been admiring the problem for a long time. What we want to do is come up with a set of very specific, actionable recommendations that can get done. Because every year that we're not where we are in terms of being able to provide the students of our public schools in the state of Arkansas with adequate broadband access, we're failing. And we don't intend to fail.
Tell me about, I guess, what you think some of those actionable items might be. I'm not trying to get you to predict necessarily, but you know you need to get speeds to a certain level in all areas of the state. You know that you're going to have some challenges in some geographic areas of the state where the terrain doesn't allow for easy deployment of some fiber in the ground, for instance. Maybe speak to a few of the actionable items that you think are probably going to come out of this.
Well, sure. And, you know, you can look at this issue, and any big issue, you've got to start breaking down into bite sizes. And the way I look at it, there are three or four buckets or big bites. One is getting the capability to the schoolhouse door. Then once it's at the schoolhouse door, what do? You have to have a network within the school itself that is adequate, that can be accessed by the teachers and accessed by the students with enough distribution of the capability so that they can do what they want to be able to do. And then third, you've got to have a set of policies around that as well. And how much is needed? What is the digital strategy for education in the state of Arkansas? What is it? What is the it that we should build towards? You know, what is the ultimate solution that we need to go towards? So it's not just our group, but the State Board of Education, the governor's office, and everybody really has to start looking at all three of these things. And then the fourth thing, of course, is taking into account what the students and the teachers want. And the way I look at this issue as well, if we don't solve it, the kids are going to solve it for us. Because they're growing up in a digital world.
Yeah.
And they're becoming true digital natives, to use a term. Mm-hmm. And when they're very, very conversant with technology in their non-school lives, and then if they walk into a school and all of a sudden they're back in the day when I was in school and in the 60s and 70s, they're going to fix this.
That was Axiom Executive Jerry Jones speaking with Roby Brock from our content partner, Talk Business Arkansas. Support for Talk Business Arkansas on Ozarks at Large is provided by Mitchell Williams Law, providing strategic counsel on a variety of sophisticated legal matters since 1954. Mitchell Williams Law Firm combines decades of diverse professional experience to clients across the U.S. Today, the firm employs nearly 80 attorneys from 4 offices in Arkansas, Texas, and New York. Online at MitchellWilliamsLaw.com.
And Bank of the Ozarks, committed to helping business owners succeed by combining the tools and services businesses need with accessible experience and knowledge. More information at bankozarks.com. And the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas, diversity is the key to reliability and affordability. From the state's largest industrial user to a home at the end of a long country road, the Electric Cooperatives of Arkansas serve members with a stable supply of electricity backed up with fuel diversity. More at aecc.com.
A native Benton County man has quietly been devoting years to restoring Ozark native prairies. Ozark's at-large's Jack Woolen Froelich files this audio postcard of the land steward, Joe Woolbright.
The sound of an ancient prairie alive with dick sisals and goldfinches feasting upon ripening seeds. Chesney Prairie Preserve is an 82-acre parcel wedged between a contract poultry farm, a busy highway, and a cattle field. A herd of cattle quietly chew on fescue along a shady fence for a watching. Chesney's a tiny remnant of a much larger, now disappeared prairie ecosystem, says Joe Woolbright, steward of this parcel.
And Northwest Arkansas was a mosaic of prairie, savanna, woodland, and forest. And so over the years, man introduced various crops and the native plants were plowed under, and it was replaced by a handful of species like fescue and Bermuda grass and Johnson grass.
Only 600 acres of tall grass prairie remain in Arkansas, so this is a really special place. And Joe Woolbright knows this landscape well, being sixth generation Ozarkian, born and raised 3 miles southeast of here.
My great grandfather came down here from Barton County, Missouri, and you can see there. His old home place from where we're standing. The old house is still there. He built in the late 1800s. And both of my great-grandparents lived next door to each other. That's how my grandparents met. And when my mother was 80 years old, she's now 101, she was 80 as she wrote her memoirs about growing up, and it read just like Little House on the Prairie. So after reading that, I set out on a mission to find all these tall grass prairie remnants left in Northwest Arkansas. And we've had some success in working with folks to save. As far as I know, we've located most of all of those remnants that are left, and they are now under the stewardship of Ozark Ecological Restoration.
That's his nonprofit, established in 2008.
And our mission statement is restoring unique Ozark natural communities to pre-settlement conditions.
Woolbright is a retired electrical contractor. 2 of his sons now work with him. They work with private landholders, other nonprofits, as well as do pro bono work. His main client, however, is the Arkansas Natural Heritage Commission, owner of Chesney Prairie, an agency of the Arkansas Department of Heritage. The commission was established in 1973 to identify and protect the state's natural landscape, protecting rare, threatened, or endangered plant, insect, and animal species. Woolbright operates according to Heritage Commission best management practices, and his primary tools, fire and herbicides.
We have a specific herbicide that we use on really high-quality prairies called Plateau, and this herbicide can impact and either eliminate or suppress non-native species, but not hurt a lot of the native species. On prairies, historically, we know from research that prairie fires historically, normally, or generally happen between July and October. And when you do fall burns, it enhances the forbs or the flowering plants the following year.
An ocean of native tall grass prairie once rippled across the middle U.S. from Canada down to Oklahoma. More than 900 million acres. Of that, less than 1% remain. After weeks of heat and sun, Chesney had wilted to brown, but recent rains have coaxed the ecosystem back to life. We walk along mowed hiking paths, which loop through Chesney, patches of big blue stem, little blue stem, Indian grass, and switchgrass are everywhere. Our herd of cattle are likely longing to get into this field because if they could, they would enjoy a highly nutritious breakfast of forbs, some of which have not sprouted on the Ozarks in over a century. Old-timers refer to it as ice cream grass, says Woolbright, because native fields contain four times the nutrients of modern pastures. Stands of black-eyed Susans and ashy sunflowers face due east towards the morning sun. Beneath spread wild purple petunias. On the path sprout tiny clusters of silver leaves, which Joe Woolbright bends down to show us.
This is Antenaria neglecta, which is
on the path.
Prairie pussy's toes, and it's
real soft.
It's one of those tracking species.
Uh-huh.
And they're only found on high-quality virgin tallgrass prairie sites.
Butterflies and bees are everywhere. To restore an old Bermuda field back to prairie, the ground is tilled, soaked with pre-emergent herbicide and native seed broadcast. But here on Chesney, Joe Woolbright is engaged in a grand experiment. 6 years ago, he dug up a giant piece of native prairie sod, scheduled for destruction, and transplanted it here on a bit of tilled Chesney ground, a project we first chronicled in 2007 as among the first of its kind in the nation.
Weather cooperated very much with it. We had an inch of rain every week all the way through the summer, and it proliferated beyond our wildest dreams. We had, and we're not sure why, but the big blue stem actually got to 10 feet, and normally it gets to 6 to 7, 8 feet out here, but everything was larger than normal. And we weren't sure why that happened.
Unlike commercial grass sod with shallow root systems, native grass roots extend several feet deep into the ground. But Woolbright could not cut the sod to such depths. As a consequence, he was skeptical that the venture would even work, but it did. The sod experiment was initiated by the Heritage Commission. Two more strips and transplants have been done since, but Woolbright says all three have inexplicably diminished in height and diversity, but not in width.
And you can see out in along the edges that it, on either side, it's growing at a rate of about 2 or 3 feet a year, and a few seeds get blown out. So I'm seeing species that, what we call natural regeneration happening here, and that's what we had hoped to happen. If this worked, we could actually do just like you do with Bermuda grass sod. We could go into an old site and just put 5 foot wide strips, maybe 50 foot on center, and hopefully they would fill in. But that's another project we'd like to do, but there again, it's going to be a function of funding.
Tallgrass prairies are extremely drought tolerant because of those really deep roots and amazingly free of noxious insects like ticks and chiggers. Sager Creek, an ephemeral stream, flows nearby, dividing the prairie, and because the riparian way was not aggressively cultivated, mound builders abound. Pocket gophers, prairie mole crickets, a harbinger of spring, and burrowing crayfish all tend to business. Joe Woolbright describes Chesney as extraordinarily diverse.
Up here it's dry, and as you go down, it becomes damp or mesic or mesic, and you will see the plant community change. And then as we get into this one corner, there's a swamp over here that's we refer to as hydric. And it has a lot of sedges and wetland plants. And then you drop off into the little creek, you're in a riparian zone. And there's a definite line where the prairie grasses like blue stem and Indian grass just stop in almost a straight line. And then prairie cordgrass, or slough grass as it's called, takes over. Because that line where it drops off dramatically 3 or 4 feet in elevation, there's a whole different plant community. And then you have the woodland along the creek. So there's five, you know, there's dry, mesic, hydric, riparian, and woodland.
Sparrows and shrikes, blackbirds and grackles work this prairie through the seasons. Eagles hang out, as do hawks. Coyotes den here, foxes trot through, and bobcats slink on by. And Joe Woolbright can often be spotted here as well.
It's almost therapeutic to come out here early in the morning or late in the evening.
For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
You can find the fruits of Joe Woolbright's labor posted on Northwest Arkansas's Audubon Society Places to Bird section at nwaarkaudubon.org. It is Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us, Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm not sure it's Wednesday. I'm not sure what date it is. Apparently, my brain has left the building. Apparently, I need to go to the wish tree and wish for a new brain.
Which, what is the wish tree?
Makes this the Wizard of Oz. Yoko Ono's wish tree.
Okay.
For more than a decade, she's been collecting wishes. Mm-hmm. As the wishes have been written on paper, they've been hung on various trees and eventually delivered to the Imagine Peace Tower in Iceland.
Ha! Huh. How
is
about
it,
that?
Is it
Reykjavik.
Oh. Huh.
So the Wish Tree Project, which is an opportunity to contribute a wish, is currently visiting the St. Louis Museum of Art. Right. And you should Google it and find out more.
Okay.
We try to tell you about these regional things when we can figure out where we are and what we're doing. Some other art in the area. Also in St. Louis, through September 2nd, Lost Egypt, Ancient Secrets, Modern Science at the St. Louis Science Center. Speaks to my little heart. Yes, they leave that in your body. Okay. Little Rock has How People Make Things at the Museum of Discovery. Tulsa has Yellowstone in the West, the Chromolithographs of Thomas Moran.
Oh, interesting.
At the Gilcrease Museum through September 8th.
And these are all up right now that you're mentioning.
These are all up right now. And Kansas City has, through August 18th, Frida Kahlo, Diego Rivera, and Masterpieces of Modern Mexico at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art.
Very cool.
And if you've never been to the Nelson Atkins, go now. Just go. Just get in the car. Just
and
go.
It's practically next door to the Kansas City Institute of the Arts, too. You make
exactly.
An afternoon of it.
And you can go to the Kemper Museum of Modern Art.
Right.
It'll be a great time.
All right.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
And that's when we realized we had overlooked one small but very important detail. We forgot to ask Sandra which bedroom window was hers.
I've been sheltered all my life by the humane practice of courtship and romantic etiquette. I was unprepared for how the rest of the animal world likes to go about love.
Flicks his wrist, sending the eggs up into the air into two perfectly laid out slow motion backflips. But something goes terribly wrong.
Tales from the South, Saturday afternoon at 3:30 on KUAF.
KUAF is supported by Ben Owens Shelter Insurance Agency, providing auto, home, and life insurance. 582-4990 for more information. Support for Ozarks at Large comes in part from the University of Arkansas's Women's Giving Circle.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Matt Solano at work in his store on Emma Avenue in Springdale. Matt has just opened the store, the Drum Pad, on Emma Avenue. This week, in the heat of a mid-afternoon, the air conditioner was blowing hard inside as Matt brought in a drum set from his car. He already has nearly a dozen sets, from vintage to modern, set up inside the narrow storefront. He wants the Drum Pad to become a one-stop shop for the community of local drummers, a place to hang out, maybe practice a little, and seek out important drum parts and paraphernalia.
If you go to another store, a big box store, or another large music store, you might not find something there that you can find here, and vice versa. So, I mean, I have a lot of vintage parts. I can repair vintage drums. I have, I mean, thousands of parts that I've used in the past, and they're mostly vintage drums, but I can repair modern drums, and I can find parts, and I've just been around it for a long time.
This endeavor is not a knee-jerk career decision for Matt. He first took stick to drum when he was 9 years old, and he's never really lost the love for the beat. Years ago, when he lived in Oregon, he had a drum store there. He's lived in Arkansas for 8 years, and over that time, began collecting a few drum kits or parts here and there, and, well, that collection never stopped growing.
And it got to be, well, this is taking over my house. You know, it was taking over. I enclosed my garage. I took that over, and then I started using the back garage. That got filled up with drum stuff, and then it started getting into the living room. And my wife was like, this is getting a little bit too much. So, you know, I mean, even if it just turns into a tax write-off, I got a place to put the stuff.
Not all drumming accessories take up much room. Matt Solano says over the past 10 years or so, vintage drums have captured the attention of a lot of people, much like vintage guitars developed into a market years before. So if a drummer is especially particular about his or her set, only the right original part will do. Matt says he has those people covered. He has small drawers filled with even smaller little bolts, nuts, and stuff.
Like here, I have a screw, you know, or even a bolt, or a washer, or a spring. You know, so this is an original part. You know, this is an original part. So just looking at these, I can tell, well, this is from a Ludwig drum set and what kind of lug it's from. So you might have a vintage set and you might be missing one of these. This is a claw that holds the bass drum head onto the bass drum. Well, if you need one of those to make your drum set complete, then I have that part. So you're just kind of like laying it down for...
Of course, not everything about a drum is small, certainly not the sound. There are all kinds of theories about why we as a species are drawn to percussion. That it reminds us of the first sound we heard, our mother's heartbeat, or connects us to some of the earliest rhythmic sounds we might have made a few millennia ago. For Matt, there's no denying it that it's the big, booming sound that holds an attraction for him. He says it goes all the way back to his childhood in New Jersey when parades would wind through the streets. He says he would find the exact right spot to feel the boom of the marching drums.
I would want to be underneath the bridge because the drum section would go under the bridge, under the underpass of the railroad tracks on top, you know. And I would get under there and I'd feel that boom, 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 boom. And it would just like hit your chest, you know, and you could feel it in your stomach and everything. And it was just like, that's what I was living for. It was like that was a high, you know. And I still feel it today when somebody comes in and you can feel the power of the bass drum hitting you in the chest.
Matt has not just drum sets for jazz or rock bands, but drums designed for marching bands as well. Four drums, for example, connected in a row that he calls quads.
And these are just tuned differently. So they're tuned really tight.
The drum pad has the all-drum market cornered on Emma, a street with a rich history, but still with several empty addresses, though new antique stores, boutiques, and other businesses have opened on Emma recently. There are any number of places he could have found for his new store, but he says he was drawn to Emma Avenue in Springdale for a couple of reasons. He says the space has the sort of vintage hangout feel he thinks works perfectly for drummers, and he thinks Emma has a bright future.
What I like about downtown is that I see that it has a lot of potential coming back here. And if there's just more shops that would come down and, you know, more unique shops, we have plenty of like secondhand stores and things like that. This place could, you know, just have a little bit more foot traffic, and it's got beautiful buildings down here and stuff, and it's got a rich history. If drummers want to come here, like in the past when I had the drum shop, they'd come in and they'd tell me, hey, you know, I play this type of stick. This is the kind of stick I want. If you carry it, I'll come down. And it's just like a place to hang out. We got the taqueria up the street, and I'm going to be doing some stuff with them, with some live music, just try to bring people down here. And I just want to kind of make it like a community where, you know, you can come here, you can go there, you can have lunch there, you can come here, you can come down here and hang out, talk about drumming.
You will be able to talk about drumming at the drum pad Tuesday through Friday from 4 until 8 p.m. and Saturdays from 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. Matt has plans to connect with instructors who may be interested in the space to teach lessons, and he has his eye or his ear focused on the space next door for possible expansion if all goes well. Before I left the drum pad on Monday, I asked if there was any particular drummer that he'd recommend listening to.
Somebody that I'm into now is Roy Haynes, and the guy's in his 80s, and he's like a kid behind the drum set. He looks very young, and man, he can play, and it's just something I like to see people do.
Matt Solano is the owner of the Drum Pad on Emma Avenue in downtown Springdale. I talked to him at his shop on Monday afternoon.
Although researching family history is a little easier than it used to be thanks to technology, it can still be a little overwhelming knowing where to start. Perhaps it might be helpful to meet with experienced researchers, which you can do September 13th and 14th at the 33rd Annual Conference for the Ozarks Genealogical Society in Springfield, Missouri. The Ozarks Genealogical Society was formally organized in September of 1969 by a group of individuals united by their common interest in researching family history. This year, the featured speaker at the nonprofit group's conference is D. Joshua Taylor, the lead genealogist and business development manager for the research website FindMyPast.com. Mitzi Zare, publicity chairwoman for the conference, says Taylor is younger than those you traditionally see on the speaker circuit, so hopefully he will attract some new, young members interested in researching their family histories. Zare says while the event has grown over the years, it has basically remained the same.
We kick off on Friday night with a presentation by the featured speaker, which will be Mr. Taylor this year, and we start early on Saturday morning with many sessions taught by some of our people here locally in the organization, and they have different topics that they talk about, even as, you know, the very beginning of the beginning genealogy, researching in particular localities and trying to find your ancestors. And this year we're also doing Native American ancestors. But then we have a lunch that on Saturday, and we also have vendors come in who have books and CDs and maps and all kinds of materials that are helpful for you in your research. So those things have probably been pretty solid throughout the 33 years that we're doing it. But technology certainly has changed over that time.
Taylor will present four sessions during the conference, including one titled Bridging the Gap, Finding Ancestors in the United States Between 1780 and 1830. Zare says researching family from this time period can be difficult.
In the 1850 census is the first census that began including the names of all of the people in the family, including the wife, the children, their ages, on down the line. Before 1850, it only included the head of the household, which is typically the male, and it would just put a little mark indicating the female and maybe what age range she was, and then children. So it's really difficult if you have family members that are back in that time frame trying to figure out which family they match up with. So we're looking forward to hearing what ideas he has on trying to pinpoint who your family members are related to from anything before the 1850s.
So difficult, but not impossible.
No, it takes a little bit of digging, going to courthouses, looking through probate records and land records and taxes and other pieces of research material that might be specific to a locale. So tracking it back to any of those, you know, states or counties, wherever your ancestors might have lived.
Publicity Chairwoman Mitzi Zare says participants come from Missouri as well as surrounding states like Kansas and Arkansas. She admits September is a busy time of year and there are lots of events happening, but organizers are expecting anywhere from 80 to a little more than 100 participants. She says there is a core group of attendees who return year after year, but the conference can appeal to newcomers as well.
I think people from all different levels receive some benefit from it. You know, some of it, the benefit is just sitting at the table and chatting with someone who has been doing it for years and giving you some inside tips on where you can go and find information, or, oh, I can't find something on Uncle Joe or whoever, and they can say, well, look in your military records and things if he was from, you know, World War II era. So it's beneficial that young people just starting out learn a lot from the ones who are more seasoned researchers, and the seasoned ones may learn something from the young folks, too, on some of the websites maybe that they've come across.
The 33rd Annual Conference for the Ozarks Genealogical Society is scheduled for September 13th and 14th at the Howard Johnson Hotel in Springfield, Missouri. The conference is $50 and includes all sessions, lunch, a vendor showcase, and sourcebook. After August 31st, registration increases to $55. A Friday-only registration is also available for $25. More information is available at ozarksgs.org.
Here's an oxymoron for you, yarn bombing. The term refers to a relatively recent phenomenon, no more than 9 years old, that is the yarn equivalent of graffiti. Mysterious, often overnight, crochet projects turn up in unexpected places like public statues, trees, or buildings. The Eureka Springs-based Creative Energy Project is working on some yarn art, including the first ever outside of Eureka Springs work for the Creative Energy Project. On August 6th, the exhibit called Yarnography will be presented by the Norberta Philbrook Gallery at the Press Room on Central Avenue in downtown Bentonville. The artistic yarn and crochet images were dreamt up by Jeremy McGraw, a photographer and a major force behind the Creative Energy Project. The yarn creations themselves are the work of Gina Galena. Yesterday, Jeremy McGraw came to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio to talk about yarnography and about the growing cool factor of working with yarn.
Now it's become an actual sort of edgy public folk art, you know, and it's exciting and it's colorful, and it allows people to transform, you know, public spaces into these vibrant, colorful installations.
And very safely.
Yeah.
I mean, unlike graffiti,
right.
It can be removed when it's time to remove it, and no sharp edges here.
I think something about yarn bombing as well, that it inspires awe because you look at it and you know that it took a lot of time, you know. Whereas graffiti, which I love graffiti as well, but there's a quirkiness to yarn bombing. And when you look at it, the bigger those installations are, you realize, like, oh my gosh, how much time did that take to do, you know? And the fact that it could be applied to a public space with nobody, you know, being aware that it was happening, it just shows up one day, you know, and then you realize it must have taken hundreds of hours to weave these pieces together.
What are we going to see in Bentonville in early August?
Well, Yarnography is sort of a hybrid project. It is a photography project involving these sort of surreal crochet landscapes, and it's very conceptual. And so the end result of Yarnography is a collaboration between, myself and the crocheter Gina Galena. We took some concepts that I had come up with, and I sort of described them to her in writing, and then she made the sets and props and costumes. And then we went back with a kind of a team of people, and we shot these images. So it's really fun. It's very much inspired by the yarn bombing craze, but it's a conceptual photography project. It's also intended to be the beginning of a number of yarn bombing projects that we'll be orchestrating for the next year that will involve different public places and things like that. So we're really excited about it. It's kind of the starting point.
What are some of the landscapes, the images we'll see in Yarnography?
We have they're very character driven, and I like to, when I come up with projects, I write a ridiculous backstory that nobody will ever
a narrative?
Get. Yeah, nobody will ever get out of the things. But for me, it helps me to know where I'm coming from when I create these images, that they have maybe a subconscious cohesiveness to them, even if, you know, I'm not really intending for anybody to get out of it. So I came up with these different pieces that are all really about this kind of insane collection of people that have decided to solve the world's problems via crochet. And so they're crazy, but this is sort of their delusional vision of the solutions to problems as they see them. And so each one depicts sort of a different character with their vision of how to fix the world.
Yarn can be bright. So as a subject for photography, mm-hmm. is it easy to work with?
Well, that's what's exciting about it, because there's a whimsicality to the images, because I very much wanted them to look like, you know, they were created by some shut-in that, you know, is just sitting there watching, you know, television and thinking, I've got to do something. And then they start crocheting a way to sort of, you know, fix this problem. I come from a theatrical background, and it was very much like these little, you know, designing these little sets for very similar to a theatrical show. And so we come up with the character and then describe that to Gina, and she made the costumes and the props. And then I light from a very theatrical standpoint, so it's a lot of fun because I'm using the same room in all the shots, but I'm sort of transforming them, but not in a way that eliminates the room. I kind of want it to be obvious that it is this little tiny room in an apartment.
Well, the press room is not a huge place,
right?
So when people walk in,
mm-hmm.
those days in August, what will they see?
They're going to see a mixture of, we'll have six of the images that I shot that will be there mixed with some of Gina's original pieces. So there will be some giant flowers that will be sort of set up freestanding in a corner, in addition to two of her wall hangings that are these sort of they're crochet portrait, or not portraits, but they're sort of crocheted, you know, wall hanging pieces, like tapestries, I guess, but more kitschy than that. And then at the event, we'll have the characters in addition to things like we'll be selling like crocheted donuts and crocheted pieces of cake.
Yeah, I've seen a picture of the cake.
Yeah. So
that looks.
Well, we have little slices of the cake. We also
okay.
have little like miniature cakes and things like that. And those are actually pin cushions as well. And so it's just really, you know, it immediately inspires fun. And people that haven't ever seen, you know, yarn bombing styled stuff before, they usually greet it with an instant like smile like a kid. It just, you know, it gets that kind of reaction. And pulls something out of people that, you know.
How is it as a medium? I know that it's Gina who mm-hmm. who creates it, but is it a relatively inexpensive medium to work with?
It is. It's all about time. It's a, you know, it's an inexpensive medium, and really with yarn bombing, you're covering things, you know. So it's just right. whatever you want to cover. But you know, I love the way that it just reinvents things and makes them interesting, you know, it makes them quirky or fun or, you know, whatever. But it's really just about, it takes a tremendous amount of time. Even somebody that's fast, we you know, in this project, we had people that were helping do some of the crocheting. So there were pieces of it that she could sort of assign to people and say, I need this many squares of this color. And then she could seam it together. On some of the big ones that we're looking at doing in the future, it's going to take a real crew of people. This thing in Bentonville is really our first creative energy project that's outside of Eureka Springs. So it's only 2 years old. And so it's exciting that we're kind of we're leaving the city on this one. So I'm excited to see what will happen.
Jeremy McGraw is with the Creative Energy Project, and he's also a photographer. He lives in Eureka Springs. The opening for Yarnography is at the Press Room in downtown Bentonville, August 6th. From 6 until 8 p.m., the opening will feature yarn props and characters. The photographs will remain up at the Press Room through the month of August. You can learn much more about Yarnography and the Creative Energy Project at the website creativeenergyproject.com.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, a new company puts biologists and mathematicians on the job to find personalized treatment for clients willing to pay when their doctors haven't been able to help. It's a new kind of second opinion.
We might find a drug that hasn't been used commonly, but there's papers 30 years ago that said it was effective, and it turns out to still be effective.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF.
This is Ozarks at Large. Yesterday, Antoinette, we asked a question for people who were interested in winning tickets and vouchers.
We did, and you came up with a question, and you were inspired by the 110th anniversary of the first car sale by Ford Motor Company.
So we asked listeners to name specific models of cars, remembering that many cars are named after places.
Right, like the Santa Fe, for example.
The Santa Fe, exactly. But none of them are named after towns or cities in Arkansas. So we asked for a convertible car name
mm-hmm.
and a muscle car. Each winner receives four tickets to any Malco movie theater in the area and four vouchers for the 2013 Northwest Arkansas Natural Season. You turn those vouchers in at Will Call for a ticket for the game of your choice.
Yes, and we had a special judge for us.
That's right. We sent all the entries, just the suggestions, not with the names of the persons attached, to our guest judge, Tim Clark, who is the president of the Heartbeat of the Ozarks Classic Car Club. Tim is with us on the phone. Tim Clark, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Well, good morning, and thank you for inviting me to participate.
Well, the first thing you said when I sent you by email the suggestions is you were quite impressed with some of these these entries.
People were very creative in their responses, and it was quite difficult to actually select the best in each category.
Well, we'll get to the winners in a moment, but first let me ask you, what is the Heartbeat of the Ozarks Classic Car Club?
It's a club that consists of members who, quite simply, enjoy driving their cars and, quite frankly, having fun.
So what sort of things do the club members get together and do?
we have a tagline that's called drive it, shine it, and show it. Some of us built our cars, some of them did not, and either way is fine. But the club, you know, we participate in local car shows, and then every Saturday night there's a cruise in somewhere in northwest Arkansas. But our club particularly enjoys monthly car events. We go on day road trips. Sometimes we'll go on weekend road trips. Other times, like when it's really hot, like right now, we may go to a state park for a picnic, or we might do a progressive dinner. And then other months when it's cold, like in the winter, we may just get together and go bowling and such.
And can you tell us a little bit about Good Works?
Yeah, Good Works is real important to us. We're committed to local Good Works. Every year we hold a charity car show. It's a charity car show. That means we work to gather funds for a charity of our choice. 2012, we donated $12,000 to Circle of Life Hospice. 2013, our fundraising continues. And again, our charity is Circle of Life Hospice, and we'll be making a donation later in the year. We do have monthly meetings, and visitors are welcome to join in and participate as a guest at our meeting. For all of these activities, I would direct your listeners to our website, which is heartbeatoftheozarks.com.
Let's talk about the car names. We had more than 40 entries, all told, and some really interesting ones for convertible. There was, you can imagine, the Ola or the Hope. What did you pick for the convertible name?
You know, if a person looks at those suggestions and uses their imagination, they can come up with all kinds of things that could be insinuated with some of the entries. I liked Mountain View for convertible because we live in the Ozarks. You got the top down. You're cruising, so we say, the Pig Trail or Old 71 down to Alma or maybe 540 down towards Fort Smith. What do you see? You see a view of the mountains because the top's down. So I picked Mountain View.
All right, and then we have muscle cars. We had some good names there as well. Guy and Strong and Hunter, Jericho, those are some good ones. But what did you pick?
You know, Strong was a really close second because of muscle. But with if anybody's owned a muscle car, I'll tell you, they don't buy one for gas miles. I mean, they just don't go together. So with that, I selected Gasville. If you own a muscle car, you're going to be looking for a gas station. So you might want to go to Gasville.
Both submitted by the same listener.
Seriously?
Yes. So Tim Crane, those were his suggestions for each. And of course, Tim Clark, you had no idea who submitted them. So we'll figure out what we're going to do with Tim Crane. But Tim, thank you so much for your time and your effort in picking our winners.
Great. Well, thank you for letting me participate in your fun radio show.
Support for KUAF comes from the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal, now featuring hotels and convention centers, plus local business news from Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions and more information are available at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com. The 2013 Fayetteville Roots Festival is Thursday, August 22nd through Sunday the 25th. This festival of roots music, local food, and Ozark culture will feature more than 35 performers, including the Del McCurry Band, Iris Dement, Jerry Douglas, and more. Tickets and more information are available at FayettevilleRoots.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Kalamazoo.
Where is that?
Just south of Ozark.
Excellent. Have you ever been there?
No, I have not, nor have I been to Kalamazoo, Michigan.
Oh, right.
Hey, Janet Freeman submitted Strong, So she's going to get four tickets and vouchers since he said that was a very strong second for the muscle car.
Sounds fair.
Okay.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large, and have a happy Wednesday.